This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the sports betting network.
The NFL betting guide is out now, and our college football guide drops next week. Get previews and predictions for every Division I team and conference, best bets on futures and season win totals, plus an in-depth breakdown of how you can use our betting splits and power rankings to make you a smarter better this season. Sign up before the end of July and receive both guides and full VSIN Pro access all the way through the Super Bowl at an early bird discount of $175, or sign up on a monthly subscription. Get your first 30 days for only $19 to see everything VSIN has to up your betting game. Remember, this offer ends July 31st, so don't miss out on these preseason deals. Go to VSIN.com/subscribe to take advantage of these special offers and become part of the Sports Betting Network. Part of our college football continued previews include a conference that gets a lot of betting attention year in, year out, week in, week out. Once we get into the season, that is the SEC. And for that, we go to the senior national columnist for Saturday Down South, Connor O'Gara, kind enough to give us some time right now on Sharp Money right here on VSIN. And you think about the SEC, Connor, it feels like, just from my perspective, all these shows we've been doing in the buildup, everybody's talking about Georgia, Alabama, LSU, the top three in the league. I want to get your take, though, on some of these teams a little bit further down the board that could potentially surprise, even with the gauntlet that always is playing an SEC schedule. Looking at the East, where after Georgia, there's a whole lot of uncertainty there. Who do you think potentially could be a dark horse to maybe not surpass what the elite of a Georgia team will do in that Eastern Division, but could be really, really competitive overall in 23?
Yeah, I think it's South Carolina, and I think that a lot of people are looking at South Carolina through the lens of that schedule, which is really, really difficult. Bookended the regular season with UNC. Everybody's going to be talking about Drake May. That game is going to be on college. That's College Game Day's week one matchup. And then to end the regular season with Clemson, which even though they got over the hump last year, it's still a really difficult game for South Carolina. And, oh, by the way, you also have Georgia on that schedule and a Tennessee team on the road that probably would like some revenge after last year. But, man, South Carolina just finds different ways to be able to overcome their weaknesses. And they have this unbelievable special teams that everybody knows is Beamer ball, but they have these different ways to be able to overcome that. And that's forcing turnovers, which nobody in the SEC has done better than them over the course of the last 2 years. They don't miss kicks. They have unbelievable punts. I mean, Spencer Rattler is coming back as one of the better quarterbacks in the SEC, and I think there's an expectation that they can take that next step. And even though that schedule is really daunting, they're one of those teams that you look at and you're like, well, I mean, they've won 7 games as an outright underdog. They've won 4 times as a double-digit underdog over the course of the last 2 years, most notably, obviously, the Tennessee and Clemson games last year. So I think South Carolina is that team that can overcome a pretty pedestrian over-under regular season win total.
Hey, Connor, thanks for joining us. You mentioned Spencer Rattler there. We've also got Jalen Daniels coming back here for LSU, but we're losing quite a few quarterbacks here in the SEC. Georgia, no more Stetson Bennett. Alabama loses Bryce Young. Will Levis out of Kentucky. What does the quarterback picture look like in the SEC, and what are some names that we should keep on our radar?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty telling that I think Jalen Daniels being the first team all-SEC guy going into this year, it does feel like we have a lot more questions than answers. I mean, there's 10 of 14 SEC teams have new offensive coordinators, including two of the most experienced in KJ Jefferson, who I think is the best quarterback in the SEC, and Will Rogers. Both of them are going through pretty significant scheme changes, which that's going to be one of those things where, you know, maybe the casual fan might not know that because those aren't necessarily national programs, but I think that's really significant. It could definitely impact their production. But the guy to keep an eye on is Devin Leary at Kentucky. Devin Leary is someone who entered last year as the preseason ACC Player of the Year at NC State. He gets hurt midseason, pec injury, kind of an unprecedented surgery that Dr. James Andrews performed on him. And now he's at Kentucky, where they brought back Liam Cohen, who's my personal doppelganger. He was with the Los Angeles Rams, and he ran that offense in 2021, which was their best offense 14 years, and there's an expectation that Devin Leary is going to be better than Will Levis was. And even if he doesn't have the pro measurables that everybody talks about, there is an expectation that he can be a much better college quarterback. And if he finishes as an all-SEC guy, it would not surprise a lot of people.
Talking with Connor O'Gara, senior national columnist for Saturday Down South right now on VSIN Sharp Money. Give him a follow at CJ O'Gara, O-G-A-R-A. And you talk about Kentucky, win total of 7 right now, DraftKings minus 110. You mentioned South Carolina earlier. That is at 6. The over is juiced at minus 130. The scheme change, though, I think for a lot of the bettors doing their homework now, getting caught up to speed, are the most fascinating to dive deep on. though, because you look at a team like Mississippi State, who I saw the preseason poll, they're the last place pick out of the West Division with Will Rogers back at quarterback, but expected to be much more of a kind of a traditional handed off ground and pound offense than the air raid they had under the late Mike Leach's head coach. How do you expect that transition to go for a team that is not being very highly evaluated by a lot of the preseason predictions?
Yeah, I think people are sleeping on Mississippi State. Think about this. Like, how rare is it that a team that won 9 games, finished in the AP top 25, coming out of the SEC, like, returns their starting quarterback who, oh, by the way, might become the all-time SEC passing leader in both touchdowns and passing yards. Like, that could happen this season. And their preseason pick to finish last in the division? I mean, the West, SEC West is really good, but a lot of that is the scheme change, and everything is different than the Mike Leach air raid. Everything feels like, oh, it's air raid this, it's air raid that. But the Mike Leach air raid is truly one of one, and it is going to be a transition. But I think those who are waiting to see what this is going to look like with Will Rogers, I think that they're probably underestimating how good he's been in the rare instances that he's thrown the ball deep. It's not a lack of physical ability. He can do that, but there are going to be things that are getting used to. I mean, they didn't have a tight end on the roster during the 2020s under Leach, and now they just added 7 because that's what you have to do in order to execute this offense. Their tailback, Woody Marks, is somebody who just basically just caught passes out of the backfield, and now he's going to be used a little bit more of a traditional sense. They have the ability to be a prolific offense, and with Zach Arnett returning, as you know, he was their defensive coordinator, now obviously the head coach there, they have some very sneaky potential, I think. And those that are assuming that they're just going to go back to the SEC West basement, I think they're kind of overlooking what this team returns.
And when we're looking at this conference, we've got the Bulldogs sitting at -115 is your favorite. Alabama right now, +300, the second choice in the conference. LSU +450. In my mind, if you're going to try and find a way to beat Georgia, you have to look at the SEC West here because Georgia's most likely going to be in that conference title game. Do you think it's Alabama and LSU, or think there's anyone else inside the conference that could jump up and win the West and take Georgia on in Atlanta next year?
No, I think it's down to those two teams. I really don't. I think A&M should be vastly improved. I mean, when you're 5-7, the only way to go is up. But at the same time, like, A&M has never played for a conference championship in the 21st century. And, I mean, that was Johnny Manziel for 2 years, and they couldn't even do that. So I think it's just so difficult to come out of the West, and you need to be a truly elite team. I mean, the way that this breaks down with Alabama and LSU kind of having a little bit of this split consensus in terms of who's going to win the division this year, it speaks to how good those teams are expected to be. And even though there are questions about Alabama, it's like, all right, well, even at their worst, which was last year, they still finished 5th in the country. I mean, these people that are predicting Alabama to fall off the face of the earth, I think that's a bit much when they've played in 2 of the last 3 national championships. But there are fewer questions about LSU. There just are. And when you return Jaden Daniels, and, oh, by the way, you bring back Mason Smith, who got hurt on that first series on the opening drive last year against Florida State, and then Harold Perkins, who might be the best defensive player in all of college football, there is an expectation that LSU is going to be in the playoff mix. But I'm just of the belief that betting against Alabama always feels dumb, because usually when you bet against them, like when they weren't picked to win the SEC the last 3 times, they've gone on to win the SEC and win a national championship. Well, they were just picked to not win the SEC. Who knows what's ahead for Alabama this year?
10.5 on the win total, juiced to the under. It's +150 if you want to bet Nick Saban and the Tide over this year, while LSU coming at 9.5, getting attention to the over that is juiced -115. And the other team that I've noticed getting a lot of buzz, Connor, as far as the win total market is Texas A&M, where they were open at 7.5. Now bet up to 8 and starting to see a little interest even on those 8s now for head coach Jimbo Fisher and the Aggies, even though you can still get that 8 at DraftKings, juiced at even money on the over right now. Where do you stand on the Aggies heading into this year?
They should be a 9-3 team. They should be. Like, if Bobby Petrino gets to run this offense, they have all the pieces in place. I think everybody has kind of forgotten. They punched LSU in the mouth in that regular season finale last year. I mean, LSU, who had playoff chances alive, went into College Station against a 4-7 team and got smacked. They modernized some of their concepts for that game. They're running more tempo, more RPO. That's going to be the expectation, what this offense is going to look like with Bobby Petrino. If he can actually run it, and if Jimbo Fisher isn't micromanaging everything, then there is a hope that they can make that big next step, because they have all the pieces in place to be able to do it. They just need the right scheme. So I think that, you know, you look at the fact that even in these 2 years that they've been really bad, They smacked LSU last year. They've been extremely competitive with Alabama the last 2 years. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, well, if you've already shown you can do that, then you can kind of play with anyone. And while the 5-7 mark doesn't really suggest that, I think you point to that and you point to the fact that they have the highest percentage of returning production of any SEC team. That's the great set Bill Connelly puts together every year. And I think there's a lot of momentum for A&M, despite the fact that last year felt like it was very much a lost season.
He is Connor O'Gara joining us from Saturday Down South. Senior national columnist, does great work for them covering all things SEC. Connor, we really appreciate the time. Thanks so much for the insights.
Absolutely. Appreciate it, guys.
As we continue on today's edition of Sharp Money, as we'll go to break here, Mike, Shohei Ohtani guy. I've heard he's pretty good at baseball.
Yeah, he's okay. He might win the AL MVP this year.
Maybe. Just only a minus 1,000 plus favorite right now. We'll tell you what Ohtani just pulled off on what is an otherwise very, very weak and light baseball slate today, but he did something that he had never done in his Major League Baseball career before until just now. We'll explain that next. Have a bunch of sound from around College Football Media Days as well to get to here on Sharp Money.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSIN, the Sports Betting Network.
Hour number two of VSIN Sharp Money underway live from Las Vegas in our South Point Sportsbook studio. Ben Wilson in for Patrick. Great to be along with Mike Somich, who joins us today. Amal Shaw, he'll be back tomorrow. I could not but crack up, Mike, as we bring in Scott Miller from the New York Times, talk some baseball on the Angels postgame show right now. They're doing the record with and without, not Shohei Ohtani, but Zach and Neto. Angels are apparently 34-25 with 18-24 out this season, as if that is going to make the big difference
the
down
key.
The stretch. Definitely the key right there. With that, let's welcome in Scott. We were just talking, Scott, about Shohei Ohtani after his one-hitter complete game that just wrapped up a few minutes ago, and the Angels going forward 6-1 to make the postseason, and they are apparently going all in. As it stands right now, what would you give owner Artie Moreno's odds at least landing Ohtani if we go to next year and him still being in an Angel uniform?
You know, I think it's 50-50 right now. I think that could go either way. I am not surprised at all that the indications are they're going to keep him. I thought all along, all this heavy breathing speculation over the last 10 days has been way, way too over the top. Moreno indicated a while back, and the Angels have said all along, they're going to keep Ohtani at the trade deadline if they've got a chance to win, and they do. And this is a once-in-a-generation player, and if you trade him, you might as well just close up the franchise. I really think that. Now, in terms of the chances to re-sign him, your question, I say 50-50 because, I mean, Artie and the Angels are going to have the money. They'll have the money to play in the deep end of the pool, so you start there. Secondly, Ohtani knows and is comfortable with the Angels as a franchise, an organization, and a place to work. Thirdly, and this is where more of the 50-50 comes in, you know, he said all along he wants a chance to win. If they can, you know, get their guys back, and it's not just keeping Ohtani at the trade deadline, but, you know, they're going to get Mike Trout back from that broken Hammett bone before too much longer. Everybody forgets about the catcher they lost in April, Logan Ohapi, the rookie that was just terrific both behind the plate and at the plate. They should have him back before long. So I think that they've got a chance to, you know, earn a wild card spot. And if they do that and if they can win, I think that could sway Ohtani. And as I said, they'll have the money. But, you know, the Dodgers are going to come hard and fast, no question about that, as will other teams. So, you know, I think if the Angels, they're more optimistic right now, there's more positivity in terms of the postseason, I think, than there's been since Ohtani's been there. And from that perspective, that's going to give them a chance at least to keep him.
Now, Scott, one of the teams they're going to have to pass to get that wild card is your hometown Yankees here. And Ben and Dustin were just pouring dirt on their season in the last segment here. And they're an interesting spot. We've heard that they may be buyers. They may be sellers. They may just stand pat here at the deadline. They're supposed to get Aaron Judge back tomorrow. What do you think the Yankees do here toward the deadline? Is this a season they're going to try and go for it and get into that wild card?
Yeah, I don't ever see the Yankees waving the white flag. That's just not in their DNA. They'll be a different team when Judge comes back. I mean, I know right now, it's crazy to look at the standings for like the past month and see the Yankees in last place in the American League East. You never think of the Yankees as a last place team, but it's a really good division this year. I think when they get Rizzo back at the trade deadline, I mean, they and everybody else can use some pitching. I think, you know, Brian Cashman can, you know, land a starting pitcher and or one or two pieces in the bullpen, and they get Aaron Judge back. You know, I think they can still make some noise. I can't believe Boston continues to be ahead of them. I mean, you know, Boston, you know, credit to the Red Sox for what they've done. They're playing better than I thought they would, but, you know, they've been a wreck defensively, and you know, it's been inconsistent on the mound. I think there's some teams ahead of the Yankees, such as the Red Sox, who will be vulnerable if Judge comes, you know, you assume when he comes back, he'll be a presence in the lineup. That's going to make them exponentially better. And if they can improve their pitching, I think they go for it.
Right now, plus 170 on the Yankees at DraftKings to make the playoffs, had been a minus money favorite most of the year until their latest skid with Aaron Judge on the IL. As Scott Miller joins us, New York Times MLB columnist. Also, you hear him on SiriusXM MLB Radio Network at Scott Miller BBL. And I think about the other New York team as well, Scott, and how the New York Mets season has just continued to go from bad to worse. They, you know, they will get to Kodai Senga, who's been a nice rookie in that system, on the mound tonight. But as far as what to expect at the deadline, there have been the rumors about potential moving out of Justin Verlander after he's, you know, signed a big contract with them, even though he's getting up there in age. What do you realistically expect to happen there for the other team in the Big Apple approaching the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, they've kind of been a mirror image of the Padres, only they're in worse shape in terms of spending money and then underachieving. You know, I think there'll be some moves. You know, David Robertson has been late career surprise in terms of how he's, you know, he's filled in really nicely at closer for, you know, Edwin Diaz, who went down with that knee injury in the World Baseball Classic. But Robertson has pitched well enough. I think he'll be an attractive trade chip. Tommy Pham, the outfielder. I think the Mets, it'll be interesting if they move Verlander or if they're able to with the money he makes and his age. I would think there'd be – I would take a gamble on Verlander more in a short-term run. For example, if you're a team that thinks you can make the playoffs and maybe win a World Series this year, I think Verlander, given all of his postseason experience and his intestinal fortitude, I think he could help a contending team. And if I'm the Mets, I do look to see if I can make a deal, because the Mets, is pretty clear, are not going anywhere this year. And I do think they'll rearrange some things. And then I think the rest of it will be a waiting game for David Stearns to his contract in Milwaukee to expire. I think he'll be the next president of baseball operations with the Mets. And then that'll happen, I think, this winter. And then the Mets will look to rearrange and gear up for next year.
One of the most disappointing teams so far this year has been the San Diego Padres. And now there's rumors swirling around that both Josh Hader and Blake Snell are going to be on their way out before this August 1st deadline. Both of them be big time pickups for a lot of clubs that are contending. Where do you think that Blake Snell and Josh Hader end up on August 1st?
In San Diego with the Padres. I know there's a lot of rumors. I don't see the owner, Peter Seidler, and the president of baseball operations, A.J. Preller. I don't see them waving a white flag. There's too much money they've spent on this team, and I know they've been disappointing, probably the most disappointing team in the game, arguably. And they need to start winning some games. Pittsburgh, you know, they lost 2 of 3 to Pittsburgh at home this week. It's inexcusable. But that said, you know, they're still within range in a wild card race. And here's the thing. Ownership is incredibly optimistic. Peter Seidler is one of the most optimistic people you'll meet. He's not going to admit he's out of it until they're 10 games back with 9 games to go. This is a team, the city of San Diego is hugely invested in this team. And, you know, good for the city. I mean, the Padres spent, it's like the opposite of the Oakland situation. The Padres spent money, probably more money than they should have on this team. And they got to the, obviously, they made a nice run last October in LCS where they lost to the Phillies. And then there's so much optimism coming into this year. And going back to the city of San Diego that's invested, they have sold Petco Park out 40 times this year. They're going to set a franchise record with 3 million plus attendance. They're too far down the road, both in terms of player payroll and promises made to the fans, that I just don't know that they're going to wave the white flag. Now, to your point, both Hader and Snell are free agents after this year. So if they do get traded, I think it won't be a sell situation so much as a rearranging situation to retool. But I think both are going to stay put.
We're talking pre-MLB deadline with Scott Miller from the New York Times. Also, check out his book, really good read, came out a few years ago, 90% Mental. Speaking of mental, Scott, the NL Central, like, nobody knows what to make of this division. And you talk about David Stearns. You know, I'm from Milwaukee. The fact that they sold last year when they were leading the division, I'm still baffled by. What happens in that division leading up to the deadline?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm baffled. Count me as baffled with you about last year. Here we are. The Brewers lead the division by a game and a half. Cincinnati had a really nice run right before the All-Star game, and they're positioned to do some things. The team that I'm watching the most, I mean, I think Milwaukee and Cincinnati both look to add. They should look to add. That division is up for grabs. But obviously, especially in Cincinnati's case, with all those great young players they have, Ellie De La Cruz and Matt McClain and the Abbott kid pitching, they're not going to trade key prospects because they're too young and too ready to win to part with it. So I think, you know, they'll end up looking to trade marginal prospects to try to get better this year, but I don't expect a blockbuster. To me, the most interesting team in this division is going to be the Cubs at the trade deadline because they're six out. There's still a game under 500 at 50-51. And they're six out. They can make a run. It's not that far out of the question. And they're four and a half out in the wild card. Not too bad. They've got three clubs they've got to climb over. So they're close enough, the Cubs, to make a run in the division and in the wild card. But the reason I say to me they're going to be the most interesting team, of course, is they've got Marcus Stroman.
Sure, absolutely. Only team above plus run differential in the NL Central. It remains the Chicago Cubs. And sorry to cut you off, Scott. We're up against a break, but we really appreciate the insight here. Talking Major League Baseball trade deadline. Give him a follow at Scott Miller, BBL. We'll talk about the rest of the slate when we come back on Sharp Money.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Download the DraftKings app today, and new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonuses instantly. Use promo code VSiN when you sign up. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for full terms and conditions. Again, we are still waiting word more officially. I know Dustin Swielsen, our producer, is looking into that press conference from Cincinnati. But as the latest update on that, Zach Taylor, head coach, telling reporters right calf injury for quarterback Joe Burrow, who left with what looked like a non-contact injury from practice earlier today. Speaking of training camp, a lot going on right now. Probably the biggest headline until Burrow was just carted off the practice field was what is going on for the Denver Broncos and the comments made by head coach Sean Payton. I'm just blasting the previous regime and head coach Nathaniel Hackett. So for more on that, we welcome in Nick Kosmider, who joins us right now, covers the team for The Athletic. And as always, Nick, you know, it's week one of training camp, so a lot of buzz going, especially for a team that has big expectations. But I'm curious what the vibe is out in Denver now with Sean Payton. He knew what would happen, right, making comments like that, talking so negatively about the former regime. What's been the vibe out there here today?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting. You know, just for some context on this, Sean Payton expressed some of these feelings to a lesser degree during the owners' meetings in Phoenix in March when he said that the film, particularly offensively from the 2022 season, was, quote, hard to watch. He was pretty critical of the offensive operation. He had poked fun during his introductory press conference at an incident that happened in week two last year in which the crowd at Mile High Stadium was actually counting down the play clock because the Broncos were having such a hard time getting plays in and getting plays off. So some of these seeds have been planted a while ago, but I think the, I guess the, you know, the brashness in which he came out and said what he said to Jarrett Bell of USA Today in regards to last year being one of the worst coaching jobs in NFL history, saying that many people have dirt on their hands, pointing to the team's own management structure as having played a role in what went wrong last year. So there was really nobody spared from the criticism that he levied today. And I think that caught, you know, that certainly raised some eyebrows here in Denver.
And now, Nick, I know one of the most important relationships here is going to be that Russell Wilson-Sean Payton relationship. We saw the two of them together at a Denver Nuggets game. To me, this feels like it's a vote of confidence for Russell Wilson as well. To make sure to give him a pat on the back, say, I believe in you. Is that kind of the feeling there in Denver as well?
I think that was some of it, right? Like, of all this, you know, all the people that received criticism for how poorly 2022 went, nobody felt that, I think, more than Russell Wilson, and a lot of it for good reason, right? He had the worst statistical season of his career in year number 11. It was the first season in which he had landed in Denver. The Broncos had given up three starting level players, five draft picks, and then handed Russell Wilson a five-year, $245 million contract. You cannot make a bigger investment in a player than they did in Russell Wilson, and he just simply did not perform well. And I think to Sean Payton's point, you know, Russell Wilson is deserving of criticism. He's, you know, 34 years old. He knows that's part of life in the NFL. But in his mind, there were so many other extenuating circumstances that to him, the idea that Russell Wilson is a broken player who can't look like what he did for so many years in Seattle, you know, Payton flat out called that BS. And his belief, he's essentially saying, look, I am going to put the things in place that I know a quarterback needs in order to succeed because it's been tried and tested in the way that I've done it. You just have to be the player that you've been, and together that will help us get back to where we need to be. But I think behind closed doors, the message to Russell Wilson has probably been a lot more firm from Sean Payton, saying, hey, I'm going to have your back in public, but I'm going to push you in these camps with tempo, with play calling, with just about everything, and I'm going to expect you to, you know, to meet that every day.
8.5 that win total right now for the Denver Broncos. Evenly juiced, by the way, at DraftKings, as Nick Kosmider joins us right now. Covers the Denver Broncos for The Athletic here on Sharp Money. And I just wonder on the defensive side, everybody wants to talk offense, and that's all well and good. It's totally fair with bringing in a new offensive-minded head coach in a Sean Payton. But this is a defense that kept Denver in so many games last year, tied for third in yards per play allowed against on defense, and were fourth in fewest yards per drive allowed. But you look at the last couple of seasons on that front seven, have lost Avon Miller, Bradley Chubb, Draymond Jones. How do you expect the front seven to look in particular now that you go into a 2023 season with very much higher and increased expectations just team-wide?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think that Broncos have arguably the best secondary in the NFL. When you look at Pat Surtain, who might be the best cornerback in the league, Justin Simmons, who is a top three safety, has more interceptions over the last 5 years than any safety in the league. And then you add a couple young defensive backs the Broncos are really high on, guys like Caden Stern, Damari Mathis, Riley Moss, who they drafted in the third round this year, Kaywan Williams. So they're really loading the secondary. But the big question about Denver's defense, to your point, is whether they can apply pressure with that front seven consistently enough. The Broncos were good defensively last year, but in the second half of the season, they really fell off. And the biggest reason why was that they could not apply pressure to the quarterback. They were second to last in pressure rate over the last 8 weeks of the season. And they didn't replace Bradley Chubb, who they traded to the Miami Dolphins for the first-round pick that eventually allowed them to sign Sean Payton as their head coach. They still have Randy Gregory, who they signed to a massive contract last offseason, but he played in only six games during his first season in Denver, has been healthy this offseason, participating fully. There's a lot of hope and expectation that he can be that catalyst that he was in the games that he did play early last year. You bring in a guy like Zach Allen, who is essentially the replacement for Draymond Jones, played with Vance Joseph, the new defensive coordinator for Denver in Arizona the last 4 years. They view him as an ascending player who can be a 8, 9, 10 sack type interior lineman. And then you have young players like Baron Browning, Drew Sanders, who is going to start as inside linebacker, but will be, you know, blitzing the quarterback a lot, playing on the outside a little bit. They have pieces, but what they have to show is that they can stay healthy, A, and then consistently come up with a plan of attack to rotate guys, to develop young players into, you know, consistent weapons. That's something they did not have last year once Bradley Chubb was traded and once Randy Gregory was injured.
One Bronco I'm surprised we're not hearing more about is Javonte Williams, coming off an ACL injury in the fourth game of the season last year. As a rookie, ran for close to 1,000 yards and was also a threat catching the ball out of the backfield as well. What do you expect from Javonte Williams coming into this season? Is he going to be good to go here week one?
Yeah, we actually just spoke to Javonte Williams today, really for the first time as a media contingent since he was injured last October. And he is cleared for training camp. And, you know, they open their first full practice tomorrow. They had a couple of ramp-up periods the last 2 days in which he was a full participant, playing with that big brace on his right leg, but has been cleared to practice. He will be limited on some days as they just continue to kind of load manage his injury. But I would expect to see him ready for week one, and that's huge for the Broncos. When he got hurt last October, it was a ACL tear, an LCL tear, damage to the posterior coronal ligament, which I now know more about than I ever thought I would. It was a slew of injuries that they thought would keep him out a full calendar year or more, and here he is inside of 10 months back on the field. It's been a pretty remarkable recovery, and I think he's one of the more just pure talented running backs that Sean Payton has worked with in some time. I think they're going to be able to use him a lot of ways. You alluded to it. I think he's going to be a big threat in the passing game. That's a way that the Saints like to use their running backs when Sean Payton was the head coach. They also have Samaje Perine, who they're really high on. They signed him in free agency. I expect to see him have a career high in carries, go over the 100 carry mark here in 2023. So they're excited about what they have going in the backfield. The Broncos were, you know, kind of linked to Dalvin Cook there for a while. But that's, I think they're pretty happy with the group that they have right now.
I give him a follow again at Nick Kosmider. If you don't do so already, does a great job covering the Broncos for the Athletic. Before we let you go, Nick, as far as any other training camp battles or just players to watch you're really interested in, and you mentioned a Javonte Williams coming back from injury, who are a couple guys who could make legitimate differences to a Broncos win total that's at 8.5, depending on how this training camp session goes.
Yeah. Well, one guy that I would really keep an eye on if you're sort of a fantasy football player, or to your point, just kind of watching that Broncos line is a young tight end named Greg Dulcich. He was a third-round pick of the Broncos last year, but hurt his hamstring early in rookie minicamp, didn't really participate in training camp, and wasn't able to play until week 6 last year. He only ended up playing in 10 games and yet finished second among all rookie tight ends in receiving yards. He had a couple of huge games for the Broncos in the middle of the season when they were, you know, sort of flirting with being a competent offense, when they were looking probably as good as they did at any point. He's a real weapon in the middle of the seam. I think Sean Payton, you know, kind of sees some flashes perhaps of a young Jimmy Graham in terms of how versatile Dulcich is and being able to line up in different spots. Great speed, big physical guy. I would expect big things from him this year. And then, of course, Jerry Jeudy. That's the big question. Over the last 6 weeks of last season, he finally looked like that number one type receiver that they drafted in 2020. You know, was as good as anybody the last 6 weeks of the year. He is kind of their unquestioned number one wide receiver right now. And I think if he can capitalize on how he ended last season and he can continue to build that chemistry with Russell Wilson and inside of this scheme in which Sean Payton really knows how to get guys in space, I think he could be in for a really big season as well.
And he is Nick Kosmider joining us right now on Sharp Money, talking all things Denver Broncos, covering the team for The Athletic. Nick, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. Enjoy the ongoing coverage of Bronco training camp.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When we return, trying to figure out, Mike, if there's been – so DraftKings just reposted a Cincinnati Bengal win total. In our VSiN NFL betting guide, we had the Bengals at 11.5. I think that's where they were basically everywhere. It's not 11.5 anymore. We'll explain why when we come back with some sound from the head coach, Zach Taylor. That's next.
This is Sharp Money with Patrick Maher and Amal Shaw on VSiN, the sports betting network.
Download the DraftKings app today and new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonuses instantly. Use promo code VSiN when you sign up. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for full terms and conditions. Back with Mike Somich. I'm Ben Wilson here from Las Vegas, South Point Sportsbook Studio. We have another guest coming up in about 15 minutes. Thanks again to Dustin Sweetelson. It's working so hard behind the scenes, and we've got Mike Petralia coming up in a little bit here to talk all things Cincinnati Bengals after quarterback Joe Burrow went down with what was called the calf injury from his head coach, Zach Taylor. So we'll talk about that in a little bit, 15 minutes. Right now, though, let's welcome on the longtime college NFL coach in Dirk Koetter, who joins us right now here on Sharp Money. And this is a treat for us, Dirk, because we have, you know, Mike, myself, we each went to the Harvard of Boone County, University of Missouri. And for folks, I suggest that folks do just a quick Google search on Google Images. Just type in Dirt Cutter Andy Reid, because it pulls up just an iconic image on the old Mizzou, like the tiger stripe sweatpants you guys used to wear on the coaching staff when you were an OC back in the early 90s. How do you think those sweatpants have aged, Dirk, if you had to give that an assessment?
Yeah, that was when Zubas, they were called, were hot. And I think they'll probably be making a comeback in about 2029.
I think, yeah, Dustin will be leading the charge on those for sure. I have to imagine. But thanks so much for joining us. I wanted to get your thoughts just on a bunch of different topics here around the NFL. And you think about some of the guys you've worked with and where they are at now. Baltimore's just such a fascinating team here in 2023, where they are going to revolutionize the way they look on offense. And you spent time with Todd Monken, now the new offensive coordinator. How do you expect that offense to look with a now healthy and compensated accordingly quarterback in Lamar Jackson?
Yeah, I think it's going to look different for sure. And, Baltimore was already a tremendous running team under Greg Roman, but they needed to update their passing game, and Monk will definitely do that for them. And I'm excited to watch the Ravens this year. You know, Lamar Jackson's been a quarterback that's been trying to prove himself that he was a quarterback, not just an athlete playing quarterback. He's been trying to prove it for a long time. So I know he's got to be excited about the addition of Todd Monken. And, you know, they're not going to forget how to run the football, but Monk's going to add to their screen game. He's going to add to their play action game, and he's definitely going to add to their dropback game.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what Todd Monken can do there in Baltimore, specifically with the play action. I think that's going to be a huge part for Lamar Jackson here coming up in the next season. Another quarterback we talked quite a bit about here so far today has been Russell Wilson, and specifically what Sean Payton said about that previous coaching staff in Denver. You've been a head coach before. Were you surprised he came out as aggressively as he did against Nathaniel Hackett, against what was going on inside that Denver Broncos organization last year, as he prepares for this year and in the season with the Broncos?
Yeah, I was surprised. Sean Payton doesn't have to prove anything to anybody. I mean, I've coached against Sean many, many times, and he's a heck of a coach. My guess is that he had an ulterior motive there to basically throw some of the attention away from Russell Wilson and on to the previous coaching staff. I think Coach Payton's pretty cagey in how he deals with the media. I think he sort of crossed the line, but I'm sure he was doing it in a way that he thinks is going to benefit his team long term.
Sure. When you think about what he's dealing with, the quarterback and Russell Wilson coming off the worst season of his career, for someone like yourself, you spent so many years on the offensive side of the ball. How would you be approaching a guy like Wilson who might have some juice left in the tank but was objectively bad in 2022?
Yeah, they were bad. The Broncos were bad last year on offense. So, I don't think – Sean Payton had options on jobs, so I don't think he would have taken that job if he didn't think Russell Wilson could get back to play closer to the way he did in Seattle. I mean, the Russell Wilson that I knew in Seattle, that I watched a lot of tape on, was almost impossible to sack, and I thought he threw a really good deep ball. Coach Payton's always been a guy that wants to run the ball, play action, and get the ball out of the quarterback's hands quick. It'll be interesting to see. And, you know, for all of us that aren't there watching it every day and watching them in OTAs and now watching them in training camp, you know, we're not going to know for a while. But, heck, I'd like to be a fly on the wall the week they play the Jets in week four.
Well, moving on to the Jets here, let's talk a little about Aaron Rodgers, who's joining a new organization after being with the Packers for his entire career. This is an older quarterback coming in, taking on what's a pretty good offense around him. How do you think that transition is going to go? Is there going to be some growing pains early in the season here? Or do you think the Jets hit the ground running on the offensive side of the ball?
I think they will hit the ground running because the fact that Rodgers showed up for all the offseason stuff, the fact that, you know, he's got Hackett there with him, who he's got familiarity with him, and I'm sure they're giving Aaron Rodgers a lot of leeway as far as installing the system. And all you have to do is listen to the reports that have come out, and they say, you know, Rodgers is in all the position meetings and he's talking to all the guys. I think sometimes these veteran quarterbacks get a little bored and
things can get a little stale. I mean, they've made all the money they need to. He's won MVPs. He's won a Super Bowl. I think Aaron Rodgers is going to be refreshed. He's got a lot of good young players around him, and I think it's going to be fun to watch that. At AFC East, I think that's going to be a real fun division to keep an eye on.
And speaking of refresh, Dirk, I think about a team that has a refreshment around it for a completely different reason. That's the Washington Commanders with the sale now of owner Daniel Snyder, and somebody you'd worked with is Jack Del Rio. Back when you were together in Jacksonville, he's the DC now, and you think about it, so where Washington is at, not very high expectations, but what do you view to be just the optimistic look and the viewpoint for how Ron Rivera's team will show up on the field in 2023, considering that circus off the field seems to be behind them in general?
Yeah, that will be interesting to see, how much of an effect that has on everybody. I think that will affect more people that work in the building more so than the players, but that's just my opinion. I think the players and the coaches pretty much go about their day-to-day business. Jack Del Rio, Ron Rivera, coach for Jack, coached against Coach Rivera many times. We were in the same division when I was in Atlanta and Tampa and he was in Carolina. Nate Katzer, the special teams coach, I worked with him in both Jacksonville and Tampa. I think the biggest issue for the Redskins is just going to get
Actually, I know Dirk is on the lake right now, so we'll have to get a connection there with Dirk Cutter, who joins us right now on Sharp Money. But the point, and it's been great insight to have Mike, just simply because of all the different people Dirk has worked in, both in the college and NFL game. Because I think it's an interesting case study for this Washington team, right? The expectations are not high, the roster does not look very good, but like, how much do we really weigh the weight of the shoulders being off now that Daniel Snyder is no longer the owner? I think that's a valid question to ask, right?
Yeah, it's got to be tough. If you're an organization here who's trying to move on from this, and it's something that's been hanging over this organization's head for a while, it's how do you respond to that? And are they going to be able to just play more free because you don't have to worry about that Dan Snyder issue right out of the gate?
Sure, we have Dirk back from the lake, so we're working on the connection. Dirk, thanks so much, though, for staying patient and being back with us. Just wanted to let you finish the point you were making on Washington.
Yeah, I think they've got a really good coaching staff, and they've been a good defensive team. I mean, I think just their question mark is going to be the quarterback. Is Sam Howell, is he really the guy that can win games for him? Unproven. I mean, maybe he can, but just compared to the other teams in their division, they've got the most unproven quarterback, and that's just a tough situation to be in.
And now, Dirk, we've had two quarterbacks that really jumped out to me last year in the market improvement that you saw from them. Geno Smith up in Seattle, Jared Goff up in Detroit. Both had career years. Which one do you think is more likely to have that, to be able to repeat that success this year with the offenses surrounding them?
Oh boy, that's a good question. And I don't want to slight either one of those guys, but I'm going to say off the top of my head, just people seem to be a little bit more excited about what the Lions are doing. And I think Jared Goff's playing with a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. I'm sure Geno is too. But I think Seattle wants to run the ball and play defense under Pete Carroll, where I think Detroit, they're going to be a little bit more wide open and let Goff influence the game. They still want to try to run the ball. They've got a good one-two punch at running back. But I think both of those guys, I mean, it was awesome to see those guys who had maybe in some people's eyes gone backwards in their career have a nice resurgence last year. And, there's so many hardworking guys in the NFL that are just waiting for the right chance, the right opportunity with the right coach and the right system. So that was fun to watch those guys last year.
Yeah, no question. Really excited to see how that will translate into 2023. Dirk Cutter, kind enough to give us some time today on VSiN Sharp Money, the longtime NFL and college coach. Dirk, thank you so much for the time. Great to have a few Mizzou guys. I know you bleed black and gold at heart, Dirk. So great to have you on. Thanks so much.
I bleed a lot of colors, but I hope the Tigers do well this year. You guys, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And, special shout-out to Dirk's daughter, Kaylee, who is taking over. She is the first-year head coach Wyoming women's volleyball team. So great. Looking forward to seeing how the Cowgirls do in the Mountain West this year. So congratulations to Kaylee. Really excited, having known her for a few years, Mike, to see how they do up in Laramie. All right, when we return, time to talk more Joe Burrow and the Bengals. Mike Petralia will join us to give us the latest from Bengals camp.